From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
This is FSN. Thanks for that. Welcome to Wednesday's programme, July the 15th, 2020. It's not like July at all out there. It's pretty miserable, I don't mind telling you.
It's the BBG, not the BBC. You're listening to the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester.
We've got each other. Yeah.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
The Irish doctor, Marcus de Bruin, Dublin, will be based in Dublin, of course, a GP who's made headlines, not just in Ireland, but outside of the country as well, in recent weeks, because, well, he's been rowing against the tide when it comes to coronavirus and wearing masks and vaccines and all of that. So Marcus de Bruin returns to the programme. He'll be with me this hour. Don't miss him. All right. And if you've got anything you'd like to add to that conversation, you can tweet it, as usual, through the Twitter thing. Yes, indeed. Yes, it's all about masks today. I know. Masks everywhere. Masks and wearing them and where you'll need to be wearing them and how long that will go on for and whether you are exempt or not. And that's been the talk today, the talk of the town or the tune today. Yes. And, oh, by the way, they've decided to give a knighthood to Captain Tom Moore, the retired army captain, who I think might be 100 years old. I hate when people say 100 years young. I hate that old patronising old claptrap. He's ancient. I think he might be 100. He walked around his garden and touched the hearts of the nation. Pathos. And managed to help raise 33 million quid for the NHS. Okay, so they're going to knight him. I know. Why are you telling us that? I don't know. I'm just telling you. Masks. A lot of presenters on the radio and the television in this country today are telling us that we should shut up and bloody well wear the masks.
I'm now wondering. Here's my take on this, okay? Essentially, I think I'm a coward. I think I'm probably a coward.
At least he's honest.
And I'm going to say, stick that flipping mask on your face and stop moaning. Get the mask on your fizzog and let's just work on the basis that there might be something in this. Should we just work on that basis? Do you want to take those odds?
Yeah, that's Ian Collins, Talk Radio, afternoons. I'm a bit of a coward, me. Get those masks on because it might do something for you. It might do. Honesty, eh? James O'Brien, LBC, not wearing the masks is tantamount to going out only wearing your undercrackers.
I read a great line from one of the Tokyo correspondents of one of the national newspapers this morning that simply said, going out in this country without a face covering is like going out in your underpants. One of the loveliest comments I saw was that in the conversations about face coverings, you should replace the words face coverings or masks with clothes below your waist. You sort of turn it into an issue of decorum and public policy. So whenever anybody says, I'm not going out, I'm not going to wear one of those masks, you translate that into, I'm not going to wear any clothes below my waist. And it puts an entirely different complexion on things. We've really struggled in the past, in a good way. I mean, like intellectual struggles.
I'm sure you've had plenty of intellectual struggles, Jimmy boy.
To justify the jailing of that man who refuses to put clothes on. Do you remember? Is his name Brian? A fascinating character who sort of sees it as a mission to not put clothes on, and they keep locking him up for outraging public decency. And actually, the conversations we've had about why he should be forced to wear clothes in public were among the most unexpectedly fruitful ones that we've had on the programme, like the real left field stuff.
That'll give you the level of the programme right there. You want to categorise the programme, you want to characterise it. We talk about locking up eccentric old dudes who want to walk around in the nip. In their birthday suit. And we intellectualise that, says O'Brien. And where's he going with this anyway? What's it got to do with the face mask?
Get the question right. It can be like a Pandora's box of fascination. But it's similar, isn't it?
Not really.
No, why should he have to wear underpants in public?
Why should anybody have to wear underpants in public?
Well, outraging public decency is surely a lesser offence
outraging public decency, surely a lesser offence, then I bet you can guess what's coming next.
Potentially killing someone.
Wow. That's a leap of intellectual... I can't finish the sentence. Wow, yeah. We've spent a lot of time trying to explain why we believe an old eccentric guy should be locked up for wearing no underpants in public. Or going out just wearing his underpants. But surely that's not as bad as potentially killing someone. And this is the thing, you see. There isn't any... There isn't an alternative voice anywhere in the independent in the mainstream media. You might say, well, obviously, Richie. But there, in the past, you would have had... You've got Hitchens, essentially. And he writes for the Mail on Sunday. Apart from him, you've got nobody. Maybe The Spectator, but very few people read The Spectator these days. So that's James O'Brien, yeah. Killing somebody, yeah. By not wearing a mask. It's possible. Bernie in Slough... God be with the days of talk radio when I started. This brought me back. It took me back some years. Bernie in Slough, she won't be wearing the masks in public. She won't be going shopping.
The government wants us to go out to spend to rejuvenate this sleeping economy.
Correct.
So I think we have to remember a lot of discretionary spending is done by women. This is not about supermarket shopping.
Okay.
We can do that online. This is about shopping for fun. I'm 56 coming up. When I go out shopping, I want to look nice. Thank you, vanity. If I can't go out and get enjoyment and fun from shopping because I have to wear a mask, I'm not likely to do it on the high street. I'm going to reduce my shopping on the high street, which was already in difficulties. And I can't see how this is going to help high street shopping and spending at all.
Yes, Bernie. That took me back to the 1990s, running a mid-morning talk show when regular folks like us with real opinions, were able to get on air with very few filters. Real people, you know, they could get on the air. And I would facilitate that. I would put them on. And if corporations hadn't hoovered up regional and local radio stations, I'm convinced there wouldn't be any such thing as drag queen story time or dice games in primary schools where nine-year-olds will throw the dice and then discuss sexual acts openly in the classrooms. I'm convinced of it. I really am. If, you know, things had not happened the way they happened. We used to get phone calls from people like Kitty in the city. Real people, honestly. And Dan from West Waterford, from rural places, ringing you up. They wouldn't stand for it. You know, they wouldn't stand for it. Transgender story time and stuff. They wouldn't put up with it. I can think back. I can remember the voices of real people. Uncensored, pre-social media, when people weren't worried about being cancelled, they would say whatever they wanted to say. You would bring them on. Morning, Kitty. It's Kitty in the city. And she'd be like, good morning. I'm absolutely disgusted, Richie. Transvestors. Transvestors. Is that what they call themselves now? Transvestors in the school. In the school down below. Reading ladybirds to the poor, unfortunate children. Ladybird books. We can't have it. Brilliant. And that would be the way it would be. But sadly, that's not the case anymore. It's amazing to me. Oh, God. Falling fertility rates will mean nearly every country could have shrinking populations by the end of the century. And 23 nations, including Spain and Japan, are expected to see their populations halve by 2100. That's the year 2100. Okay? Countries will also age dramatically, with as many people turning 80 as there are being born. So what's going on? Well, the fertility rate is falling. And that's the average number of children a woman gives birth to. That's falling in general around the world, except for Africa. We'll come back to that. So if the number falls below approximately 2.1, then the size of the population starts to fall. So in 1950, women were having an average of 4.7 children in their lifetime, eh? Imagine it, in 1950. Researchers at the University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation have done this huge study, and they've showed the global fertility rate nearly halved to 2.4 in 2017. And they project it will fall below 1.7 by 2100. The University of Washington's Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. Well, you never Adam and Eve it. That's believe it. You'll never Adam and Eve it. But the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave $279 million to the IHME in Washington to expand its work on population control. I mean, you couldn't make this up. Okay? Gates is all over it. Listen to Sky News talking about it today. Bill Gates.
New research suggests the number of humans on the planet is to shrink for the first time since the Middle Ages. The project, funded by the Microsoft founder Bill Gates, analysed the consequences of fewer people having children.
The good consequences now. Gates' Washington University, that he's given nearly $300 million to, they're analysing the good consequences about reducing population growth. It's great stuff, isn't it?
But while countries in Europe will experience huge declines in population, it will be a different picture elsewhere in the world. Lisa Holland reports.
Yeah, let's hear Lisa Holland's report.
Concerns about climate change and the impact of so many people on the planet now has led Anna Hughes to a life-changing decision. She lives close to nature on a houseboat in North London.
Anna lives close to nature, houseboat, North London. She's a millennial. And she's an activist. She doesn't want to have any babies.
But says she'll never have children.
No babies.
Children.
There are lots of people on the planet. And there's only a certain amount of space and a certain number of resources that we have here. So that kind of comes to a crunch point at some point, doesn't it? You can't just continue to have ever more people. It doesn't work. So I became quite aware of that. And I thought, actually, that's not something I want to contribute to.
So she won't be having any babies.
The current global population is nearly 8 billion. New predictions suggest the number will peak in 2064 at nearly 10 billion, but the figure would then decline to around 8.8 billion by 2100. Many of the fastest shrinking populations will be in Asia and Europe. Populations are expected to more than halve in Spain, Italy and Japan. And it's predicted there will be some big population booms. The population of sub-Saharan Africa could triple by 2100 to over 3 billion.
Yeah, but not if Bill Gates has anything to do with it and his vaccines. Because that's what it's all about, you see. Gates' vaccines are about attacking fertility in African females. And this is fact, not conjecture. That's what's going to happen. African women will increasingly be finding that it's more and more difficult to become pregnant because of Billy's poison jabs. That's a fact. Mad stuff. Bill Gates, everywhere. Everywhere you look, it's not just in the UK. It's not just in Europe. It's in the United States, every academic institution, all working on getting vaccines into people and warning about the dangers of overpopulation. Gates, of course, his parents, or at least one of his parents, was a eugenicist, was a firm, a devout believer, evangelical almost, in the need to reduce the population of planet Earth. This is mad stuff, I tell you. Mad stuff. A convicted paedophile has lost a Supreme Court challenge over using evidence in court gathered covertly by paedophile hunters. Didn't we speak to a paedophile hunting group on this programme a year or so ago? It was interesting. And they caught a guy called Mark Sutherland. The group in question is called Groom Registers in Scotland. No, it isn't. It's called Groom Resisters in Scotland. And they caught Mark Sutherland in the act of attempting to make indecent communication with a child. They caught him. And he's a bit pissed off about that. And he basically said that his human rights were breached. His right to privacy. His right to privacy now was breached.
What kind of fuckery are you?
Yeah, there I was, minding my own business, talking about sex to a minor. What's the world coming to if a man can't talk about sex to a minor in peace, eh? I've got a human right to privately groom a child. Chop his bollocks off, chemically anyway, but that doesn't work, does it? No, no incitement to violence now. None at all, none at all, none at all. Jesus. The robots are coming. The robots are coming, apparently. I don't know if you've seen this. The robots are coming. We've talked a lot about this in recent years on programme. And very interesting story on Ian King on Sky News today about how robot cleaners are going to take over Heathrow Airport. But I'll tell you what, I'm looking at the clock and I know that I've got to get to Dr. Marcus de Bruin really soon. So I'll leave that story till maybe a little bit later on. Will I? Or will I do it now? No, we'll do it now. We'll do it now. We have time. Yes, robots. The chief executive of Heathrow Airport, John Holland K, was on Sky News with the business guy Ian King. Cleaners are on the way out. Robot cleaners, droids are coming in. Yeah. Really?
Now, today you're announcing the introduction of cleaning robots at Heathrow. What's the advantage over human cleaners?
Well, I've seen the test of the UV robots, and this is a robot which we can program to go around a room and to use ultraviolet light to clean a toilet facility, for example, to a standard that is a medical grade. And so if you're traveling through an airport and you might be concerned about whether the surfaces you're touching could have been contaminated, the UV robot will zap any kind of bug that could be there, including COVID. So it's a very good, thorough way of giving people the reassurance that surfaces are absolutely spotless.
Are they cheaper than human cleaners?
No, I don't think they are. This is about health and safety, and we are taking a number of measures across the airport, investing significant sums of money to make sure we can keep people safe and confident when they're travelling.
Yeah, I don't think they are, he said. Well, they obviously are, and they will be in the long run, won't they? Obviously. What advantages do they have over human beings, said Ian King? Well, obviously, we only have to buy them. They last for years, and we'll never have to, well, they'll work forever. They won't take any breaks. And they'll do a better job of cleaning the toilets. These are mad times. And the amount of people, they admitted today, the government admitted today, that 1.5 million people, at least, currently furloughed at home, doing nout, are going to find out that there isn't any job to go back to. And there aren't any jobs out there that they can do. Yeah. You know, there aren't any segues for them. Well, we can't move into this industry or that industry. There won't be anything there. Not even manual labour jobs. They won't be there. Robots are on the way in. According to the BBC and Sky this afternoon, coronavirus parties are all the rage. California YouTubers are being called out for their selfishness today, having parties while one in a million people are getting a cold. Selfish bastards, can you believe it? Coronavirus parties. Does anybody know what goes on at coronavirus parties? Anyone? No? No. I didn't think so either. Mad times. New statue in the place of the Edward Colston statue in Bristol. You'll remember that a few weeks ago, Black Lives Matter protesters tore down the statue of the slave trader and dumped it into the bay. Well, the plinth remained, of course, but there's a new statue there today of a black woman. Who, you ask? Is it Baroness? Baroness Amos, is it? Is it Naomi Campbell? Is it? That always reminds me of one of my favourite questions on Les Dennis's Family Fortunes. Fantastic, that. Name a bird with long legs. You remember that? Name a bird with long legs. Naomi Campbell? No, not Naomi Campbell. Let's hear BBC Radio 4's Today programme. Not Sade, not Bonnie Greer. Who did they put on the empty plinth in place of Edward Colston? Well, they put a woman on called Jenny Reed because apparently she jumped up on the plinth after Colston was dragged away. Here's Jenny Reed live on BBC Radio 4 this morning. Jenny Reed.
It's obviously a compliment, and it's great that that Mark has asked me to take part and collaborate with him on doing this. And, you know, I think something like that, I hope it brings about change. There's definitely a change in the air, and obviously this will keep, you know, the conversation going. Yeah. That's what I hope.
There will be people who are delighted to see you up there. There'll be others, you know, Jen, who'll say, hold on, we can't have public statues that celebrate lawbreakers. What would you say to them?
I don't think it's a case of celebrating lawbreakers. You know, Colston's no longer there. And, you know, it's time for change. And there's a statue there that symbolises black power, Black Lives Matter, and we just have to keep moving forward.
Black power and Black Lives Matter. Jen Reed there, whose statue currently adorns that plinth where Edward Colston's statue once stood. but doesn't anymore. 22 and a half minutes past the hour. Going to take a tune. While we do that, anything you'd like to say to me, do so via the medium of Twitter. Marcus De Bruin, the doctor in Dublin, will be with me in a couple of minutes' time. This is Wednesday's Richie Allen Radio Show. And this is The Who. Welcome to the programme. Music from The Who on the Richie Allen Radio Show. It is Wednesday's programme. The time is coming up for 26 minutes past the hour. No sign of Dr. Marcus De Bruin just yet. We'll give him a couple of minutes. We're scheduled to be talking about now. Very interesting piece in the Irish Times today about an interview that Marcus gave to Red FM's Neil Prendeville on Monday about the wearing of masks and also about the lockdown. A lot of criticism for, not so much for Marcus, but for the radio station itself and for the presenter for not playing devil's advocate, for not questioning the opinions of the GP and basically going along with the answers he was given. Talked to Marcus about that this morning. We'll get into that with him in a minute if we can. In the meantime, I'll read out one or two of your tweets before we give him another try. Hi to Fabrizio Nocevelli. How you doing, Fabrizio? How you doing? William Henderson says, well, maybe coronavirus parties are a little bit like chickenpox parties. Yes, you've got to be over 40, I reckon. Maybe not, maybe 30, maybe 35, to understand what a chickenpox and measles parties were. This was when the thinking was, way back when, that if a child got measles or chickenpox, the best thing to do was to get your own child mixed up with him or her so that your own child would get measles and chickenpox and then get over it and obviously build up a natural immunity to it thereafter. So yeah, coronavirus parties and all of that, yes. Love that. Hi to Cave Hillbilly, how you doing? Yeah, those radio show phone-ins back then were genuine. They were real, with real people. And I truly believe what I said earlier on. If the corporations like Global and like Bauer and like others, and Bob Geldof had a huge stake in a company that bought up hundreds and hundreds of local radio stations around Europe, if that hadn't been allowed to happen, I believe it would be far more difficult for lunatic ideas like getting very young children to talk about masturbation. That just wouldn't happen. Because while you might laugh at Dan from West Waterford and you can hear the cows in the background mooing while he's on the phone to you live on the radio, these were decent people. These were, I don't want to say God-fearing people because I don't know if I believe in God or not, but they were moral people. And they would phone up and they would say, come here and I tell you, did you hear it, the news? They're teaching children how to play with themselves in second form. They wouldn't have it, you see. And they would be legion, these people. Let's try Marcus again. I'll try him while I'm chatting to you. And if we don't get him this time, we'll move on with another tune and then we'll see what's going on. I'll just chat away with you in the meantime, as I am prone to do. As I am wont to do. Prone to do, wont to do, whatever. I don't know what the hell's going on. So let's see, can we get Marcus on? Right, I think Marcus might be there. Welcome back then. It is exactly 28 and a half minutes past the hour. Writing in the Irish Times today about that interview I referenced a minute ago, Shane Raymond, writing about Dr. Marcus De Bruin, writes, a doctor who resigned from the Irish Medical Council in protest over the government's handling of COVID-19 in nursing homes said the lockdown was a mistake and he opposed the use of masks. Marcus De Bruin, a practicing GP in Rush in County Dublin, told The Times yesterday he stood by comments made during a radio interview that healthy people wearing masks were essentially preserving a huge population of potential hosts for the coronavirus. Speaking to Neil Prendeville on Red FM on Monday, he said, did Dr. Marcus, not only do I think that healthy young people wearing masks is unnecessary, but I think it's also quite dangerous. Marcus De Bruin, Dr. Marcus, welcome back to our programme. How are you?
Not too bad, Richie. Nice to hear from you.
And nice to hear from you, and I do mean when I say thanks, because I know you're up to your bloody eyes with your practice and everything else that's going on. How can wearing masks not be some way beneficial in, you know, preventing the spread of germs? I'm not thrilled about the idea of having to go into Salford next week and shop wearing a mask, and I don't like it, civil liberties and all of that. But a part of me is wondering, well, even if it only prevents 20% of infections, sure, it can't be a bad thing. Why am I wrong?
Well, first, just to correct you there, Richie, you mentioned the article was in the Irish Times. It wasn't. It was in the UK Times.
It isn't. Oh, excuse me. You're right. You're right. You're 100% right. Yeah. I'm looking at
There's good reason for that. The Irish media have essentially got an entire lockdown on any sort of objection to what's going on in terms of our process over here. So there's a real kind of a media blackout for anybody to offer any sort of analysis or outside of the public health kind of guidelines that's going on at the minute. But I suppose to answer your question, why are masks unhealthy? Well, look, I mean, there's a number of reasons why, I suppose, there's a number of ways that you can answer that question. You can answer that question just from the basic kind of science of mask wearing itself and whether they work or whether they don't. There's a huge amount of evidence to say that they don't and they're not effective in viruses and that sort of thing. But leaving that aside, my main kind of point that I was making on the Neil Prendeville show and my main point in general is that essentially there are only two ways of dealing with COVID. I mean, that's the UK and most jurisdictions had to make that decision earlier on in the crisis, and that's either we adopt for a natural-based immunity in the healthy population or herd immunity, or we try and dampen down and suppress the virus and kind of wait until a vaccine comes. They're essentially the only two approaches that we have. There is no other kind of outside. Different countries have a different kind of a nuanced approach to either of those two, but the country that's obviously followed the herd immunity or natural immunity approach has been the Swedes. So in my estimation, and looking at the figures, and a lot of doctors and a lot of professionals who are looking at the figures, in my estimation, the Swedes got it totally right. The correct way of dealing with this is to allow a degree of immunity in healthy people. And if we do that, then we're going to suppress the virus using natural mechanisms, using Mother Nature, using the same kind of mechanisms that cold viruses or coronaviruses, because remember, coronavirus is 40% of the common cold virus kind of load every year is down to coronaviruses. So coronaviruses are naturally suppressed in the environment every year through a combination of natural factors, herd immunity or natural immunity, and seasonal variation when you have longer days and increased UV light. So the point is ultimately that essentially if we're all going around wearing masks and healthy people are wearing masks, well, it's not kind of weird and wacky science, or it's not a conspiracy theory to remind people that when healthy people are preserving themselves, trying to protect themselves from the virus by wearing masks, and the jury's out if that even works, but let's assume that it does work, whilst healthy people are protecting themselves from the virus, what we're essentially doing is preserving a huge volume and a huge number of potential hosts for the virus in society. And I don't think any scientists would disagree with that, because that's the objective. That's the point of wearing the mask, to protect you from getting infected. But the real issue here is that essentially the only out, the only escape for the road that we're going down is universal vaccination. And I think we have to be very, very careful when we're being kind of pushed and herded down this particular road. Then we have to have some degree of dialogue as to what exactly is going on. So there's absolutely no equivocation or no kind of tinfoil hat wearing behind the assertion that when we wear a mask, we're protecting ourselves from the virus, but in doing so, we're providing the virus with a huge number of potential hosts. And this may come back to bite us in winter if there is a resurgence of the virus, as the natural factors start to diminish and the days get longer, and if the virus resurges in the winter time, which it may very well do, then what we're doing, I believe, certainly, is fundamentally wrong. And the proof of that, as I said, is in Sweden and the Swedish model and the Swedish figures. So that's kind of basically where I'm coming from, or what I was talking about with Neil Prendeville.
Couple of things there. It is interesting to me that yesterday, particularly, the UK broadcast media, we did hear from more people with your point of view. We heard from a few academics of note who said that they don't think the masks will do any good. So there has been a little bit more balance yesterday. On Sweden, because my listeners know that I'm opposed to the lockdown, layperson though I might be, and I don't like the idea of wearing masks. I've got to mention on Sweden, I would like to believe that the black and white facts of Sweden are that Sweden didn't enforce a lockdown and has done okay. But the state epidemiologist in Sweden is a guy called Anders Tegnell, and he's been telling anybody who listen in the last few weeks that Sweden, in fact, got it wrong, and that if they got the chance to do it again, that they would impose a lockdown and do it very early. And he actually told the BBC that the high death toll in Sweden that is emerging, because new figures are coming out to say that Sweden didn't do as well as we thought it did, he says, because they failed to keep it out of care homes. Now, they didn't apparently allow sick people go from hospitals to care homes. They say in Sweden that we didn't do enough to keep the disease out of care homes. So if we got the chance to do it again, we would enforce a lockdown. So maybe the Swedish situation is not as black and white as maybe we think. What do you think?
Well, I think we have to be very, very careful in kind of, you know, I suppose, dissecting what different scientists and what even Swedish scientists might say, and what kind of what science is saying in general. You know, in retrospect, certainly a lot of care should have been afforded to the vulnerable population and that. But, you know, the main point here is I mean, essentially, if we're going to talk about elderly vulnerable care homes, we have to have a handle on some degree of reliable information, of factual information. I mean, who are we to believe in all of this? Scientists are telling us one thing, you know, epidemiologists and different countries and different media are presenting different kind of figures or different kind of analysis of the figures. I think, you know, for the layperson, what we've got to hold on to, what all of us have got to hold on to, is there is a simple fact that's universal and is accepted by all scientists, and it's a fact in terms of COVID-19. And that fact is that of the mortality, of the death, between 92, in Ireland it's 92%, in other countries it's up to 98%, but the deaths within COVID, 92 to 98% are in the over 65 age category. Now, that's an absolutely crucial point. Because, unfortunately, every time that you read in the media or you hear on the news this notion of deaths per million, well, that deaths per million figure completely and utterly ignores this reality. Like, for example, I mean, the UK's got 10 times the Irish population. So the UK's got about 50 million people. Ireland's got about 5 million people. But there's a huge, the UK's got nearly over 20 times the number of over 65s. Now, in the same respect, Sweden, for example, is 10 million people, and Ireland's got 5 million people. So Sweden's got twice the number of people, so double the population. But Sweden's got 2 million over 65. So it has three times the population of over 65s. So when we and the same, the death rate or the mortality for COVID is the exact same. It's 92 to 98% over 65. So I suppose to give you a kind of an example of how we might look at this, the constant number that's thrown out by kind of media politician is this deaths per million. But let's kind of take a little analogy. Let's say, for example, you have two countries and both of them have a million people in each country, right? And let's say we have a disease that's got 92 or 98% mortality in just black people. Now, I know this is a little bit crude, but it helps to make the point. So if we've got a disease that's got 92, 98% mortality in black people, that's where all the deaths are, 92% of them are in black people. Let's say we've got two countries, and we've got one country with a million people, and it has 100 black people living in that country. Well, let's say all of those black people die from the disease. Well, that country would report we've got a death rate of 100 per million, right? Let's take another country where you've got 1 million people and you've got 500 black people. Well, let's say only half of the black people in this second country, let's say 200 of those black people die. Well, that country would report a death rate of 200 per million. So it would appear that the second country's got twice as high the number of deaths as the first country, where all of the black people were killed or died from the disease. So do you see how fundamentally dangerous this statistic of deaths per million is? It's so egregious and so wrong, but it's consistently used by the media to point to for kind of particular, or to, it's used for particular agendas. Now, if you take, I mean, I did the calculations in terms of, and a couple of people have done the calculations, in terms of deaths per 100,000 over 65-year-olds. Well, when you do that, you get a completely different, and this is a realistic, this is the proper way to be looking at the deaths, because remember, that's where 92 to 98% of the deaths are. So when you do that, and you compare the deaths per 100,000 over 65-year-olds in Ireland, well, up to about 2 weeks ago when I did the numbers, we've got 232 deaths, and the Swedish have 228 deaths per 100,000 over 65-year-olds. So when you look at the facts, and when you look at kind of the in the actual group of deaths, you see that the Swedish model, with or without lockdown, it doesn't really make much of a difference to the mortality.
This is really important.
Yes, I mean, all countries will say we should have done more for the elderly and we should have kind of helped more. But the real statistic that we need to be looking at is where the deaths are, which is in the over 65. And that gives you a totally different view or a totally different look at what actually is happening.
And there's still not many people. I'd like to play you a tiny bit of audio. I'm not springing a surprise on you now. This is, it's a guy called Stephen Reicher. And he's a professor of psychology at the University of St. Andrews. Now, amazingly enough, Dr. Marcus de Bruin is our guest this hour. Amazingly enough, this guy is on two COVID advisory boards, one for the UK, but also one for Scotland. And he's not a medical doctor, he's a professor of psychology. Now, he was speaking to BBC Radio 5 this morning, Nicky Campbell, and he briefly touched on the infection rate. And I thought it was incredibly low. I was startled by what he said. And this guy is advocating for a much slower exiting of lockdown. He wants lockdown to basically stay in place for as long as we possibly can. Listen to what he says about the numbers. It's only literally 30 seconds. Have a listen.
And I think probably to date, it is a matter of slow and cautious is winning the race. Because when you look at the figures, and you cited the figures on deaths, on infections, if you look per million of the population, so you take account of the big population difference between Scotland and England, the rate in England is hovering about 10 per million. Coming down a bit, but not coming down very much, and that's a concern. In Scotland, it's hovering just above 1 per million.
Marcus, I'm a layman, so I don't have a Scooby-Doo at the best of times. I really don't.
Yeah.
But he just said there that infections are at about 10 per million population in England. I'm guessing that what he means is that if they test a million people, they get 10 people that are infected. If that's the case, that's nothing, is it? I mean, that's negligible. And then he said it's only one in Scotland. Do I understand that right? He's saying that 10 per million people are infected. We've only got 10 infections per million people at the moment.
Okay. That's what he appears to be saying. But yeah. I mean, again, Richie, you know, I think if you get onto Google and you put in COVID-19, you're kind of gone. You're just going to be hit with this absolute tsunami of experts saying different things. You know, look, I can only rely on, and I consistently and continue to rely on, and I think people with a bit of common sense consistently rely on the factual stuff. This notion of per million, deaths per million, that all of that sort of thing, infection per million, all of that sort of thing completely negates the basic fact that we've known about COVID since it started in China, and that is that its mortality is in the over 65s. Young, healthy children, young people, they don't die of COVID. You know, there aren't a huge number of complications in children or young, healthy people who get exposed to the virus. So we have a mad sort of a situation of a huge kind of a global kind of a panic, which, you know, maybe there's reason for the panic. But I think outside of the panic, we've really lost sight of the basic kind of fact about who dies from COVID, who has a serious risk from COVID. Do you know, I mean, at the end of the day, the UK model was based upon Professor Ferguson, the Imperial College's model that it came out with. Now, you know, and he predicted, that model predicted at the outset somewhere in the region of 500,000 deaths if the UK went down the kind of herd immunity route, and 250,000 deaths if it didn't, you know. But at the end of the day, that model was proven to be incorrect.
Nonsense.
It was proven to be faulty. It was proven to be wrong. You know, Oxford, major big players in the scientific world have come out and said, look, that model was entirely wrong. You know, the question is why then, if that model is wrong, why then hasn't the UK or hasn't Ireland gone back to the drawing board and established a different kind of a model based around a more natural approach to accepting natural forces of nature and accepting the bigger picture of this. You know, my argument to that is that when you have governments that are hanging in by their fingernails, like you have in the UK and like you have in Ireland, any notion of revision is particularly dangerous because it comes with the implicit suggestion that something was gotten wrong.
Well, I hear you.
And
I hear
that
you.
That comes out.
Yeah.
There's big political accountability if that happens. So I think we're all being pushed down a road in order to cover political arses and to cover a lot of politicians. But the facts and the truth of COVID have always kind of been there. And at least they're getting a little bit of airtime now and a little bit of focus now. And people are starting to kind of see things. But I think any scientist in charge of any country will always kind of say, look, we could have done things better. Look, we could have done things differently. But when you look at the numbers at deaths per 100,000 over 65-year-olds, you see the facts of how well or how unwell nations have done. Because as I said, it's 92% of those deaths are in the over 65-year-olds in Ireland. So you can't look at this kind of deaths per million, and we have to be very, very careful about what's been done with numbers. A lot of people in the UK are very, very antagonistic towards the Swedish model because that has political implications for the leadership over there. And the same thing over here, big political implications for kind of leadership. So this is both a scientific issue and it's both a political issue. And I think that's where a lot of the real problems are coming in this kind of marriage, this very unhealthy marriage between politics and science.
No doubt. Just two things. I hear what you're saying about the politicians, and I would ordinarily agree with you. I think the Conservative government here, with the majority it achieved back in December, I think it's pretty safe for the time being, but I hear you loud and clear anyway. It's startling to me to hear that 230 over 65s out of 100,000 died. I don't want to sound callous and, you know, uncaring about elderly people, but it doesn't sound like an awful lot. We might come back to that, but I want to ask you to comment on this if you can. Dr. Marcus de Bruin, whom I think is a fairly gutsy doctor and, you know, an Irishman to be glad that he's around asking questions where others won't ask these questions. We'll come back to the media in a moment. But I've been watching, obviously, the media here in the last 36 hours and I'm worried. I've worked at every level of the media. I'm a journalist. I majored in English and history and I'm not stupid. But I know when the wool is being pulled over my eyes, Marcus, and I believe that when the UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock is now telling us that scientists are discovering, now it actually isn't scientists, it's doctors in Italy, in the Lombardy region. He said they are discovering now that COVID just doesn't end, that it leaves many people with debilitating illnesses that go on for years and years and years and years. This really worries me, and it worries me all the more. We're back to the media being asleep. The fourth estate is asleep. Nobody's challenging this. It's very scary for people. They're hearing that, oh, you had COVID, did you? And it went away. You had a bit of a wheezy chest. You weren't able to breathe. You were a bit sick for a while. Well, you might have heart disease. You might have kidney problems. I know you'll be aware of these stories, but what's your, you know, early opinion on these emerging stories?
Look, again, I mean, the crucial word there, and I think into what you're talking about, is stories. You know, I mean, look, you're always going to have some anecdote somewhere. I suppose the only rule with science is that there are absolutely no certainties in science. And that's, you know, except that one, you know, there's, it's very, paradigms shift, you know, scientific theories kind of change. You know, science is not completely and entirely infallible. You will always have exceptions. Like, I mean, we don't have, in Ireland, we've got the highest rate, for example, of cystic fibrosis in children and the highest rate of asthma in children. So we have the highest proportion in the OECD of very sick kids with respiratory problems. Now, we haven't had one COVID death in a child in Ireland, you know, with even amongst those high-risk groups with illness and disease. But, you know, I mean, all it takes is for, you know, one to come along or one to happen. So there'll always be. There's no end. If scientist wants to go dig in and find one exception to the generality and kind of foist that up to the world and say, oh, look, science is completely wrong. Here's the example.
you know, and then it emerges kind of later on that there were other factors or other things or other that, you know, we have to be looking at the big general picture as to what is going on. And if to be very, very cautious when scientists or when people with political agendas come out with kind of a few contrary examples to what might be going on, because science kind of survives on the basis of theories that standing the test of time, you know, and it is kind of, you know, when an idea has come out or when something is recognized, it becomes established and it, within the scientific community, if it's frequently over and over and over kind of tested. And that applies to these small little kind of contradictions or outliers, you know, that when they're looked at over and over again, we see that kind of they break down and there's other reasoning and that sort of thing. So, you know, the real difficulty here, I think, is politics, you know, that like there is essentially when if there's any degree of revision, that comes with a huge amount of political accountability. And I mean, I suppose the first concern for politics, for a politician, the first concern for me, and I'm sure the first concern for you, is my livelihood, the ability to feed my family, my status in the community as being a respected kind of GP, and your status as to what you're saying and that people can have faith in what you're saying. So if you kind of are faced in a situation where you might have to go back and say, oh, look, I think we might have got it very wrong here, you know, in the political world and in our private worlds, that comes with huge consequence. So I think an awful lot of what we're getting in the media is really arse covering and kind of pushing people down a road. Because remember, as I said at the outset, there's only two ways of dealing with this whole crisis, and that's either natural or herd immunity or mask wearing and suppression and all of that. But, you know, I suppose one of the ironies, or perhaps the biggest irony is, in all of this is, if, like in Ireland, if in the UK, people are wearing masks on buses and people are wearing masks in the shops, look, not everybody is doing that. You know, you could never say you're going to have 100% of the population following those guidelines. So certain number, a certain percentage will kind of not follow the guidelines. At the end of the day, we do that. That provides the virus, or provides us all essentially, with the Swedish model through the back door. Because in Sweden, nobody's wearing masks, and nobody's wearing masks on the buses and that sort of thing. If only a few people break the guidelines over here. Remember, COVID got into the UK and got into Ireland by one person. So, you know, a virus doesn't turn around. A virus doesn't operate on democratic principles and doesn't say, well, 99% of the UK population are wearing masks, therefore I'm going to disappear, I'm going to go away. You know, that's not going to happen. And, you know, mask wearing is never going to get rid of the virus. It's only going to follow this kind of rather ridiculous notion that we can keep it down suppressed until the vaccine gets here. So the wearing of masks essentially locks us in to a vaccine, and there's huge interest in that, huge financial interests, huge kind of corporate interests in that. And it locks us into the no revision of kind of, did we make mistakes? Are we going down the right road or anything? So I think those two factors are kind of pushing us down a particular road where the evidence and the science and the facts are saying, listen, we got it wrong, the Swedish approach is right, and we need to revise, you know.
Dr. Marcus de Bruin is our guest. A couple more things, Marcus, today. Wendy Barclay is a professor at Imperial College in London. She was interviewed by Andrew Marr on the BBC on Sunday morning. And when I was in commercial radio, I could be fairly confrontational with my guests. And I couldn't believe Marr didn't take her apart. She said that we're seeing, or we're hearing things, she said, along the lines of that the virus leaves our bodies kind of like an aerosol, and it hangs around in the air. And Mara asked her for how long, and she said, well, we've seen it hang around in the air for up to an hour. And I laughed out loud, and even without a medical degree or any real, you know, background in epidemiology or virology, I would have taken her to the cleaners. And again, I began to think, this is surely now more about, you touched on it there a minute ago, and I know that you've said in interviews recently that you would rather not be doing the job than imposing on people that they should have a vaccine that, you know, wouldn't do them any good or they didn't need. But when you hear stuff like that from Wendy Barclay and it goes unchallenged, and, you know, you can't but conclude that there seems to be consensus amongst the politicians and certain scientists anyway, and certain financiers, that we must keep banging the drum about how dangerous this thing is until we get a vaccine ready. And I know you're concerned about that. And is it true that you've said that you'd rather not be doing the job than pushing an unnecessary vaccine?
Well, you know, if what I've read about COVID and if what I think the vast majority of people, you know, can believe about COVID, you know, it's dangerous in a particular group of people. Its mortality is specifically defined and it's pretty much universal across the board in countries. It's the death of our over 65s and between 92 and 98% of all the deaths across the board. That's a pretty universal statistic. You know, I've been vaccinating children at my practice. I've had my own kids vaccinated. I've been vaccinating kids for some 15, 20 years now, you know. And the whole kind of science of vaccinating is, I mean, I'll give you two examples. In two of the vaccines that I use to vaccinate kids is, one is called rotavirus. I believe they vaccinate kids for that in the UK. And another, perhaps meningitis B or that. Now, you or I, tomorrow you can go out and you can get rotavirus. You get diarrhea from rotavirus and you have a bad diarrhea. Maybe you're laid up for a day or two or maybe not. But you get a bad dose of rotavirus and you survive through it. You're not vaccinated for rotavirus. Nobody insists that you should be ever. If a young infant or a newborn gets rotavirus, well, there's a really good chance they'll survive if they get a diarrhea or that. But in certain instances, it has a high mortality or a high problem risk of hospitalization or that in young infants. So we vaccinate the vulnerable. You don't get a rotavirus vaccine and neither do I, but we're just as likely to pick up the bug as an infant. But the infants are at risk. So we vaccinate them. Now, if we've got a disease where 92 to 98% of the deaths are in over 65s, what the hell are we talking about vaccinating the entire population for? I mean, that goes against all of the basic kind of science that I've learned in college, that I've learned in medicine. It goes against the basic practices that I've been doing in medicine for 20-odd years. It goes against kind of basic, it goes against almost every principle of medical practice. So this bizarre kind of inversion of kind of medical practice and medical science where we're treating the external environment as something of a hospital ward and having, you know, healthy people going around wearing masks and children wearing masks, people wearing masks driving their cars, telling doctors to vaccinate people against a virus that's completely harmless to them. You know, we really have to stop and ask some questions. But, you know, if we go down this mask road, the only out, the only escape is, you know, we're being locked into universal vaccine because we've theoretically at least preserved a huge number of potential hosts in the population so that when winter comes, you know, and that point that scientist you were referring to about COVID living in the air. Look, I mean, COVID comes from your nose when you cough or when you sneeze. So the virus is exposed. It's on surfaces and it's in the air. Now, how long it hangs there and how long it lives there, that factor, that question, that very crucial question, that's completely determined by the length and the amount of UV light exposure, because that's what destroys the virus. So as we move into winter and as the days get shorter, well, that defense, that natural defense that causes the seasonality in common cold and the seasonality in flu, that natural UV light defense, that's running out. We're on a timeline with that. That's running out and that's dipping down ever so days getting shorter. So it's very, very likely we're going to see spikes in the winter. And it's very, very likely that these policies, these ludicrous policies of protecting all the healthy people, we're setting up the perfect storm. We're preserving the virus in society. We're preserving a huge number of potential hosts in society. So, you know, only time will tell when we do hit the winter as to whether they've got it right or whether they've got it wrong. But in my opinion, they've got it entirely, entirely wrong. And as I said, when you look at the Swedish deaths per 100,000 over 65, it looks, the facts don't tell lies, and it looks like the Swedes have got it perfectly right. Of course, they made mistakes, you know, everybody has done. But when you compare, I mean, our death rate, 248 or whatever in Ireland per 100,000, and the Swedes just kind of slightly above that, you know, we're in around the same sort of mortality rate. So all of this stuff, I think we've got it desperately wrong, you know.
Well, one final question is in two parts, and thanks for coming back on today. Dr. Marcus de Bruin on the line to us. I suppose for millennia, we would have viruses would have been, you know, in and out of populations through natural herd immunity. We've heard from other doctors on the programme about that. Two final questions. One final question in two parts. I know that the media will try to portray you as being anti-vax and anti-science, even though you're not. You're patently not anti-vaccination. But I'd like to ask you one question in two final parts. One, I got the BCG when I was younger, and I know you would have gotten it as well. I've had doctors on from the US. Now, these are GPs. They're not alternative medicine practitioners. They're GPs like yourself. They're very concerned about the amount of vaccines that we are now giving children before they are 5 years of age. They talk about the immune system not being up to it, and they're very concerned about that, saying that we give too many. And the second one is a bit cheeky, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want, but I have heard for many, many months now, and even a couple of years, from Irish women, genuine women, who believe that their daughters took ill after they got the human papilloma vaccine Gardasil. And all they want, none of them are anti-vax either, they've been portrayed very badly in the Irish media, all they want is that someone does a very genuine and honest investigation into that. So if you could just give us a comment on those two things. You might not want to get into the Gardasil thing, but maybe you will. But the doctors who are concerned that we're giving too many vaccines to children now, we never did it before, why are we doing it now? What do you think?
Well, look, I suppose the short answer to that is I have to put my hands up and say I don't know what the short answer to that question is. I mean, I've been working in medicine, as I said, for 20 years. I follow the national guidelines. I follow the HSE, the government guidelines, and I stick to the vaccine schedule that the government recommends.
Yeah.
You know, and through this process, the kind of recommendations and what's going on with vaccines and certainly what's going on with the COVID vaccine, that has certainly caused me to have some serious questions, you know, not just about vaccines, but about medicine in general and about guidelines in general and how much health and how much politics, because I think all of this COVID is brutally contaminated by politics, the kind of this deaths per million shit that's kind of touted out all the time when it's a totally unrealistic statistic, is brutally contaminated by politics. And look, throughout this kind of crisis, I really have to ask myself now, and I think, you know, many physicians should be, and many, particularly people like me, general practitioners who rely very heavily on guidelines, on government guidelines, issuing guidelines, and not just about vaccines, but about kind of medicines in general, and a lot of the things we're doing. You know, how much has that horrible contamination of politics and private enterprise and private interest, how much has it influenced our public health in general and what doctors, the guidelines that doctors are supposed to follow, you know? Because I would never not follow, say, guidelines when it comes to kind of vaccinating kids. And if the state turned around and said, you have to vaccinate people for COVID, then, you know, I would have to do it. If people came in to me and said, oh, I have to get the vaccine for the sake of my job, I don't want it, but, you know, I would have to give it to them. But I think if it comes to that point, I would probably have to think about, you know, getting out of medicine and maybe doing something different, because it's a very, very difficult position to be in when you're following kind of guidelines. And now with this COVID, one of the things that this has exposed is that guidelines are not always right. I mean, I wouldn't be here talking to you, for example, if I had complete faith in the guidelines that are going on at the minute. I mean, you know, I mean, one final point that I'd make is the kind of chief proponent of mask wearing in Ireland is a Professor Luke O'Neill. Now, when I studied microbiology in before I did medicine, Professor O'Neill was one of my lecturers in Trinity College. And Professor O'Neill is the most kind of vocal and most public figure on mask wearing in Ireland. But Professor O'Neill's relationship with GSK in terms of his funding and his research, he's a co-founder of a biotech company that manufactures ingredients that can be used in vaccines. I'm deeply, deeply concerned about this kind of crossover between politics private enterprise. And, you know, in terms of vaccine, you know, vaccines in many respects, this COVID has kind of, this whole crisis has really exposed what's going on or what may be going on, or even the simple unreliability in some of these guidelines because of that horrible influence of kind of politics and medicine. So, you know, I don't know if that really answers your question.
No, it does, it does,
well, you know?
No, it does, Marcus. Just give us, go on, I'm going to press you. Give us a quick thought on the women of regret who are worried about Gardasil. They at least deserve not to be mocked by the Irish media and by the Irish health executive. They deserve a bit better, don't they? I've met these women. They're not crazy conspiracy theorists.
Absolutely. They most definitely do. And any person who feels that they've been a victim of medical negligence, and I don't think that the doctors giving the vaccines and following the guidelines are essentially guilty of negligence. The doctors themselves have to. We have to. I've no choice but to follow the state guidelines, and I've no choice but to have faith in those guidelines. And many of the doctors who give vaccines have to kind of start asking some questions now about, you know, many of the guidelines that we're getting. But those women definitely deserve a voice, deserve to be heard. I mean, my own kids, there was when the swine flu vaccine came out a few years back, I remember my daughter was going in to get the vaccine in school, and I told her I didn't want her to get the vaccine because I didn't think that swine flu was going to be dangerous to her, and I didn't have any faith in a rushed vaccine. But she was very embarrassed, and she was saying, oh, Dad, I'm going to look like a terrible person if I have to sit in the class and say I don't want the vaccine. But she said to me, she came home that day, and I said, well, how did you get on? She said, Dad, there was one other kid in the class with me, and the two of us had to sit out when the other kids were getting the vaccine. And she said, I spoke to the other kid and I said, oh, why aren't you getting the vaccine? And the other kid said, oh, my dad's a doctor and he said you shouldn't get get the vaccine. So, you know, I think in many respects, you know, certainly when there's side effects, and then it emerged after the swine flu, it emerged that there was narcolepsy, there was other complications, and there was big legal cases where it was proven that the vaccine had these terrible side effects. So, you know, I think we really do need to be asking some questions about the relationship between government, vaccine makers, scientists have to declare their interests. As I said, we're being herded down the road by Professor O'Neill insisting we should all wear masks, and yet the only out to the mask scenario is a vaccine, and nobody seems to be asking Professor O'Neill to, can you at least state if you have any relationship with the vaccine makers or that sort of thing. So, you know, there's a lot of dodgy stuff going on, and my sympathies would lie with any victim who feels that they've been a victim of a vaccine, and they really need to get together. I mean, my advice would be get together and form a group and keep protesting, keep focused, don't lose heart, don't let the media put you down. I mean, I've been vilified in the media
for simply
saying I'm a fan of Sweden. I've been accused of being a tin hat wearer, a Nazi, a eugenicist, all sorts of crazy things, when I'm just kind of looking at the facts as I see them. So I would say to those women, stay strong, and, you know, there are people who will eventually listen, and hopefully change will happen. But, you know, I'm sorry, I can't offer them more than my condolences and hope that they'll be listened to. But,
well, do you know what you did, Marcus? Do you know what you did? You didn't call them child abusers or lunatics. And I think if any of them are listening, they'll appreciate that. I thank you again for your time today. I know you're really busy, and I've enjoyed listening to you again. Fascinating stuff. I wish you all the very best. I hope you will, as it develops, I hope you will consider us and come back on again when the time warrants it. But fair play
to
you, Marcus.
Absolutely, Richie. Look, it's very good. And look, fair play to you. As I say, there's a media blackout in Ireland, unfortunately. Yeah. There's nobody allowed to kind of contradict the mainstream narrative. So, you know, fair play to yourself. Keep up the good work, you know. And just remember that deaths per million, absolute rubbish. You know?
It's nonsense. Well, you brilliantly illustrated that, Marcus. Thanks again. God bless. Look after yourself.
Well, Richie, great talking to you.
You too,
my
friend. Bye now. Bye. Dr. Marcus de Bruin there live from his practice in Rush in County Dublin. I'm glad he said that about the women of regret. I really am. You know me, I'm no virtue signaller, you know. I'm not. And it's been a long time now since I've heard from Anna Cannon or some of the other ladies. But I believe them. I passionately believe them. Not because I want to believe them. Because I'm not anti-vaccination either. I'm anti-medicines being given to people that haven't been rigorously and robustly tested for safety. And vaccines are not tested for safety. They're not. It's a fact. And vaccine manufacturers have been basically indemnified against the consequences of giving bad vaccines and bad doses. And I believe those women in Ireland. And I think as an Irishman who's not been home for many, many years, it's shocking to me that they would ask questions about the illnesses their daughters have been struck down by in a very short time span, having got Gardasil. And then when they ask questions about that, be labelled child abusers. And that's not me exaggerating. Child abusers, they were called, by idiots who work at Oxford University in physics, who know nothing about virology or vaccines or how medicines are manufactured. I'm thinking of idiots like David Robert Grimes. But the Irish media have done a lot worse than David Robert Grimes, and it sickens me, you know. It sickens me. Emotional terrorists, the former head of the Irish Health and Safety Executive, called these women emotional terrorists for asking questions about Tony O'Brien is the guy's name, Jean Ann is telling me, for asking questions about the safety of a vaccine. Well, fair play to Dr. Marcus de Bruin. I'm with you till about half past the hour. It's a slightly shorter show today. I wasn't at my desk for most of the day. There was a frantic the frantic day for me today with lots going on. Nothing to do with the programme. I had to take the smaller dog, Leia, the golden retriever, to the vets. Again, for the second time, dear listener, since January. We've got an old mutt named Jazz, God love her, crossed between a collie and a German shepherd. She looks like a German shepherd. Mongrels, nothing kills them but time. 'Tis only time that kills them. You never bring a mongrel to the vet. Jazz was brought to the vet when a dog bit her in London and she had to have a few stitches. And then she was brought to the vet to have a small biopsy done because I found a lump on her breastbone and I crapped myself. And we took her to the vet and she had a biopsy done and it came back as benign, which is lovely. Mongrels, only time kills them. But when you end up with a pedigree dog, now bear in mind we only ended up with a pedigree dog because somebody else didn't want her. You tend to find that you're at the vets pretty much all the time with them. Anyway, I don't know. Okay, I've got to change my headphones, my cans, because they've blown up, would you believe? The speaker, the little device inside the headphone that projects the sound, has blown up on me. So I've got to change my cans. While I do that, we're going to get headlines from FSN for a start. Let's go to FSN for headlines. This is the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford in Greater Manchester. 13 minutes, it is past 6 o'clock for Wednesday, the 15th of July 2020.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. The US is imposing sanctions on some employees of Chinese technology companies, including Huawei. The EU's second highest court has ruled that Apple does not have to pay Ireland 13 billion euros back in taxes. And White House officials say that one of President Trump's top aides, Peter Navarro, went rogue when he published an opinion piece slamming the reputation of Dr. Anthony Fauci.
Thank you very much indeed, FSN. 13 minutes past the hour. We'll take a very, very quick break. Back then with more comment, more chat on your Richie Allen Radio Show. How about that? How about them apples?
Renowned healer Mark Bayerski travels the world to find the most unique and powerful crystals for self-healing. Since the ancient times, crystals have been used as healing tools. They hold a natural healing vibration and are highly charged in positive energy. Mark teaches how to channel the universal energy and transfer it to the crystal to activate its healing power. Each crystal is used for its unique ability to target a different physical or emotional challenge. Mark Bayerski is an author, healer, speaker, and founder of the Pure Energy Healing Academy. He shares powerful messages of inspiration and healing on his daily YouTube videos, reaching millions worldwide. Mark's crystals, healing oils, and incense sticks are most sought after by other healers. His collection is available online at www.markbayerski.com. His work is presented through Lemon House, a company that creates and curates consciously made gifts.
Yes, they do. Visit markbayerski.com if you get a chance. He's a top man.
The views and opinions expressed on The Richie Allen Show are those of the guests and the guests alone. They do not necessarily reflect the position of the host or other contributors.
Yeah, I'm having a mare today. I'm having a mare. I fired some jingles during the monologue and they didn't work because the faders weren't up. Those of you who've ever used a mixing desk will know what I mean. I'm having a mare. It's because my mind was elsewhere today. I had lots of things to do that were on-show related. The Richie Allen website, richieallen.co.uk, has been redesigned by my very good friend Hayden Hewitt, and we're going to launch that in the next few days. So maybe some news on that tomorrow, maybe. Top man is Hayden. I'm going to take a tune. When I come back, I'm going to read some of your comments there on Twitter, and I'll have some more news for you, believe it or not. This is Morrissey, and this tune is called Interesting Drug. 16 minutes past 6 then, on a pretty dull and grim July evening here in the dirty old town. Yes, it's Morrissey there and Interesting Drug on the Richie Allen Radio Show. Bez is from Salford. You know Bez? Bez, who was on this programme in the past and a TV thing. We'll do the TV thing again at TPV Studios in Manchester. I think we're going to do it in the autumn. Rather than do the radio show on Thursday, I'll do a full show on InVision at the TPV Studio thing. Just for the hell of it. To give it a chance, give it a try, see how it goes. I really enjoyed doing that in the past with Hayden Hewitt, so we'll see how it goes there. Thanks for your tweets. A lot of tweets came in. A lot of people very interested in what Dr. Marcus de Bruin had to say. Thank you. Donkey Oti was in the pub. Well done. Been down the pub, he said. Didn't tell us too much on Twitter about the experience of being in the pub, having to sit at your table and be table serviced and only one person in the loo and sitting with your back to people, no music, no speaking loudly and all of that. I did hear from one or two people who said to me, yes, Richie, I have been in a pub and yes, we have been asked to bear in mind that speaking very loudly is not a good thing. We have been told to speak moderately in pubs. I've had emails from people to that effect saying that to me amazingly, incredibly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, listen, on masks and stuff. Wanted to play this earlier on, didn't have a chance to play it. The health secretary is a guy called Matt Hancock, and he did the media this morning. One of his stops was on Sky News with Kay Burley, and amazingly enough, Burley did ask Matt Hancock a real question. Maybe it happens twice a year, maybe. Maybe it happens when there's a full moon. She does have ginger hair, I don't know, but she does ask questions a couple of times a year. She asked about the fact that some scientists are saying that the masks are useless. She actually asked him, but sadly she didn't follow it up. Hancock took the opportunity then to talk about asymptomatic spreaders and to claim that this is a novel coronavirus, because there have been many coronavirus previously, or coronaviruses previously. This one is novel because this one is one where asymptomatic people, people who have no symptoms, they're not sick, but they have the virus inside them, they are giving it to other people. So she does ask the question, but the answer she gets is different. Have a listen. This is Burley with Hancock this morning. Oh, Jesus. Again, Richie. Again with the faders. Jesus, Mary and Holy Saint Joseph. I'm having one of those days, right? Oh, again, Kay Burley with Matt Hancock.
Yeah, except the scientists. We did a montage, I don't know if you saw yesterday on Sky News, including Jonathan Van Tam, saying there was no evidence at all that masks made a difference. Did they get it wrong?
Well done, Kay. You see, you asked an honest question. You represented the other side of it. You acknowledge that scientists are saying the masks are as useless as tits on a bull. Well done, Kay. And you see, you didn't drop down dead. You weren't struck down by lightning. It's not that difficult. Ask a good question. But he swerves it and he talks about asymptomatic people.
No, the scientists have been brilliant throughout this crisis, but part of science is that you constantly learn. And one of the things we've learned about this...
He's just not answering the question whatsoever. I'm refusing. Burley should nail him to the wall by his scrotum. Hang on a second. I asked you about the fact that other scientists say the masks are useless. Please respond. But he says, well, the science has been brilliant. And one of the things we're learning is asymptomatic people can be very dangerous. That means you and me, dear listener. We're dangerous. we could be dangerous because this is a new thing. It's a new thing. It's a brand new day for viruses. Here he is.
Science is that you constantly learn. And one of the things we've learned about this virus is that there's more asymptomatic transmission than anybody thought of. And there's also been developments in understanding of the spread. Now, on masks, it's always a balanced decision, but there's benefit of having a mask, especially a benefit to other people. If you are an asymptomatic carrier of the of coronavirus, you feel fine, you don't have any symptoms, but you do have the disease. Maybe it's before those symptoms have come through. That it's now clear that you can transmit the disease. Sure. This is novel for a coronavirus, and the scientists didn't know this at the start.
It's novel, this asymptomatic transmission. And I put this question to Dr. Marcus de Bruin, didn't I? They're now claiming that they are seeing evidence that the virus lives long in people after they've stopped sneezing and after they've regained their ability to breathe normally. That in many people, they are saying they will see kidney problems and heart problems and fatigue and all of that. Do you want to know what the future Mrs. Allen said to me the other day? You see, the future Mrs. Allen is very, very bright. Very bright woman. No flies on her. No flies on her at all. She was listening to the same report on Sky News with me, where the science correspondent Thomas Moore was making it up on the hoof, talking bollocks about how coronavirus is staying with people and giving them debilitating illnesses going forward. You know what the future Mrs. Allen said? She's not a conspiracy theorist. She's not anti-vaccine. She's not anti-anything. She has her own job and her own life. Very smart woman. You know what she said? She said, I wonder if they're not preparing their excuse for the health effects, the negative health effects of 5G. And I looked to my right because the future Mrs. Allen sits to my right in the living room. And I said, Jesus. Jesus, I said. Because Christopher Busby told me, genius, and other experts in non-ionizing radiation told me that headaches, chronic headaches, fatigue, organ damage, and so on, are natural consequences of being exposed to non-ionizing radiation. And that 5G is going to be worse again. And these are academic people. These are clever people. They're not conspiracy theorists. And the future Mrs. Allen should be doing this job because she was listening to them more than I was, even though I was listening to them very intently. And when this guy was going on about how coronavirus can leave you with fatigue, and he did say chronic headaches, he did say organ damage, or indoors said, well, do you know what? She said, they've got an excuse now for when people start complaining about fatigue and headaches and illness when 5G is switched on properly everywhere. And I looked at her and said, check out the big brain on the frog. Bejeebus. That's exactly what she said to me. Hi to Larry Jazz. Now, what a top man Larry Jazz is. Top DJ and radio presenter on the Costa del Sol. Lovely bloke. Got to know Larry during our time on the Costa del Sol. I miss you too, Larry. It has to be said. I miss, especially on the 15th of July in Salford when it is chucking it down and I've been soaked into the skin, walking the dogs and going to the vets and all that. How you doing, Larry? Lovely to hear from you. Richie, he says, missing you here on the Costa del Sol, he says, still driving. Most people, he said, most of us are still driving solo with masks on. People are driving solo with masks on with the new directive. And in fact, even before, he says, at least I've seen many not covering their noses. So at least they are breathing fresh air and not exhaust fumes, says Larry. That's a good point, Larry. And the doctor made that point, didn't he? That covering your mouth and your nose with a mask is not healthy. And in fact, a lot of doctors have said this. And to be fair to Kay Burley again, Kay Burley did make that point to Matt Hancock, but he ignored it. Liz Jones says, Richie, novel equals story. So when they say novel coronavirus, They mean it's basically a story. It's horse shit, basically. Listen, I'm going to love you and leave you. It's been a mad day here. Just about got on air. Thanks to Marcus de Bruin for coming on. Thanks to you for listening. Shorter show today. Not sure what's happening tomorrow. I'll tell you why. Because I've got to be... I've got to get to Hayden Hewitt in TPV Studios tomorrow to work on the website, to take photographs, to make a video. So tomorrow's show could be something different. I don't know what it's going to be, but we'll do something. So play it by ear and we'll see how it goes. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Wednesday. Don't grumble that you've got a 90-minute show instead of a two-hour show. You'll take what you're given, won't you? Thank you. Going out with the Ramones. Until tomorrow, it's bye from me. Thanks again to Dr. Marcus de Bruin. Thanks, Marcus.